So the topic for this evening is a very big topic, mental health and mitzvot. I want to begin, first of all, by thanking Shari Shemayim for hosting this evening, preparing the copies, setting up the room, and so on. And in general, for the partnership over the years that we've been running this medical ethics / medical halacha series. For those who are not familiar with the series, we do these on a somewhat monthly basis between here and the Bayit up in Thornhill, trying to pick topics of practical relevance. We are indeed accredited for 1.5 hours of CME through the University of Toronto. Please make sure that you silence your cell phones if at all possible. In the event that you know how to turn them on vibrate instead of silent, we'll take it. Note that I send out follow-up emails after the session about things that come up during the session that require expansion. So if you're on the email list, you will get those. It will also be sending out an email evaluation. It's a few questions. We need it in order to be able to keep up our credit with the university. It's a simple and straightforward questionnaire. Finally, please note that nothing I say tonight should be taken as medical advice, and I am not a doctor, and even if I were, I'd still say that, but also it should not be taken as psak, even though we will be dealing with issues of Jewish law as they relate to mental health situations. Nonetheless, for all practical issues, please, please see your rabbi. So if you take a look on the sheets, you see here four cases. What we're going to try to do tonight is, for the purpose of our discussion, take a broad view of mental illness. And we're going to look at cases across the board. As you'll see here in the vignettes, eating disorders, trauma-related illness, schizophrenic psychosis, OCD. And what we're going to try to do is apply halachic principles to those cases. So here you see the four. We are not going to go through at the beginning a discussion of what do you think for each one. We will when we get to the practical implementation. Right now I'm just introducing them. First case. Susan, age 14, is undergoing nutritional rehabilitative therapy for life-threatening anorexia. Her treatment team helps her develop healthy eating habits through regular meals while she works on her underlying emotional issues. Yom Kippur is coming, right? A biblical fast day of great seriousness within Jewish law. Must Susan fast? That's going to be question number one. Question number two. David, age 55, has been in counseling for 30 years for anxiety attributed to lifelong emotional abuse by his father. The abuse was largely verbal through criticism, insults from early childhood through the present. David's father passes away. Is David obligated to sit Shiva? And the implicit point within it, I realize I didn't actually word it that way, is David does not want to sit Shiva. So the question is David faced with an obligation to do so? Third case. Samantha, age 25, is hospitalized with schizophrenia. Her doctors believe that her delusions place her at risk of self-harm. Is Samantha's family obligated to arrange kosher food for Samantha? And here the implicit element, which I should have stated explicitly, is that the top place for Samantha, medically, is a place where kosher food is not available. So is there an obligation for them to pursue kosher food? And then finally, Abraham, age 18, experiences severe OCD with a particular manifestation in the area of prayer. He cannot complete key lines like the Shema without hesitation and repetition, which drag on for more than an hour at a time. During the treatment process, Abraham's psychologist would like to try ERP, exposure response prevention. The idea being that he is supposed to recite the prayer, as I put in here, but just say it once. So he's in the situation that triggers the OCD, but he's not supposed to respond to it. So I have a couple of psychologists with whom I consulted when preparing the cases, and one of them mentioned the possibility that ERP may not be considered the best way to treat this particular patient. I'm working with the papers that I've read that suggest that CBT in general is the optimal way to deal with an OCD and scrupulosity type of a situation. ERP is one method within CBT. It's not the only method. There's ACT. There are other methods. The point is not to give medical advice once again with this case. This is what the psychologist wants to do here with Avraham. Wants to try ERP, instructing Avraham to recite prayers just one time, even if the pronunciation or level of concentration are halachically inappropriate. And just keep going. Is that acceptable? Meaning, if Avraham knows, I'm not saying the prayer properly, what does that now mean? Is Avraham able to follow the advice of the psychologist and say, just move on? Those are our cases. Now, unlike what the regulars are familiar with from our medical sessions, I didn't include a lot of secular medical information here on the source sheets because the focus tonight is relatively narrow. The question is not so much the broad question of how will halacha versus how will medical science approach a particular condition, OCD as one example. Our question is fairly narrow. Where the medical professionals are telling you to do X, how does halacha deal with the challenge that X may pose? We're taking as a given that what the medical advice entails is some level of contradiction or violation of what one would think of as normal halachic standards. So, Samantha, who is going to be in an institution with her schizophrenia and she can't have kosher food available to her, what will halacha say in response? Perhaps in another shiur, we'll focus more on particular conditions that are here. We've already dealt with OCD and eating disorders in other sessions. Perhaps we can do that more in other sessions and look at both the medical sources and the halachic sources. But for now, the medical information that we're going to be looking at is the given. And the question is, how does Jewish law respond? So when you talk about mental health and Jewish law, very often the following question comes up. And this, to me, is the most important part of what we're going to talk about. How could ancient sources say anything relevant regarding mental health and mental illness when so much of the science and so much of the understanding of what's going on has only developed in recent decades? A fundamental and very important question. Our contemporary understanding of mental health and mental illness, biological basis for it, refinement of our understandings of emotional and intellectual processes, the nuances of the impact of trauma, all of these are of relatively recent vintage. You're going to tell me you're going to go back 2,000 years to Talmudic sources that are going to have any comprehension or application of the issues that are involved. But here I think it's really important to understand one key point about medical halacha in general. Much of halacha, much of Jewish law, is concerned not with the roots and the causes of phenomena, but rather their impact on us. An impact which has always been, in the case of mental health, visible. To take it to a different area of Jewish law altogether. Jewish law prescribes brachot, blessings to recite on food. There is one type of blessing that's recited on what are termed in halacha yirakot, usually translated as vegetables. On the other hand, there's another type of bracha, another type of blessing that is usually recited on tree fruit. So little kids, when they go to a Jewish school, are taught that the bracha on a banana is borei pri ha'adama, the blessing that you normally associate with that which grows from the ground, like a vegetable. It's the same blessing as for a cucumber or a tomato, even though we think of bananas as growing on banana trees. If you were to ask a botanist, the botanist might tell you, that the banana has a much closer relationship to a tree fruit than it does to a cucumber. But from the Jewish law perspective, the issue is when I look at this plant, and in particular the banana tree, where the section the banana grows on is going to die back every year the way that a vegetable does, so the impact on me is to view it as something that is coming back differently every year. It's not perennial, it's viewed as being annual, again, in terms of a person's perception, and that's all that's going to matter. Or a different realm, maybe an easier one to grasp. one of the rules of kashrut, one of the rules of kosher food, is that a Jew is not allowed to eat bugs. Creepy, crawly creatures are not kosher. You will tell me, you could use a microscope, look on various materials, and find all sorts of things crawling around that are not visible to the naked eye. Maybe that means that those foods should not, in fact, be kosher. However, the rule within Jewish law is, you don't go based on what the microscope will perceive, you go with what the naked eye perceives. That which you can see with your eyes is what matters. It's all about the impact on you and on your experience. And the same thing is true when we talk about mental health in Jewish law. Meaning, it's all based on the impact on the person, an impact which was visible in ancient times, even without an understanding of why the person was ill, what was generating the person's condition. So, for example, there's a classic Talmudic source that talks about somebody who is sitting on Shabbat and is gripped by Ruach Ra'ah, literally, evil spirit, such that they feel driven to be in the dark. And the question is, are you allowed to extinguish the light for them? You fast forward from Talmudic times 2,000 years ago to the 11th century, 12th century, and you find rabbis writing about that and invoking the term melancholy, which was the term that, already going back to the time of Hippocrates, was used to describe what phenomenon? Depression. That's what they're describing. Without any clue about where depression was coming from, that wasn't the point. The point was, if you have somebody who needs to be in the dark, and it's Shabbat, and the light is on, are you allowed to turn off the light in order to take care of their need? They're dealing with it on the basis of the impact. Ditto in terms of Jewish law as it relates to hallucinations, to delusions. The fundamental question is, given the impact of the illness, Are there obligations of Jewish law for this particular situation? And again, whether they understood why the condition developed or not, they saw the impact. And so the literature we're going to be looking at is literature that addresses not the root of the illness, the root of the disorder, but rather its impact. And I think that's a very important introductory point. Along with that, the fact of the matter is that our scientific understanding of mental health is still in flux, it's still growing, and you can see it when you look at the changes in the DSM from one edition to the next, you can see the way that it evolves and the debate that surrounds the DSM and why was this changed and was it changed for the right reasons and so on and so forth. The truth is that the challenges of contemporary science do create challenges for properly applying Jewish law. For example, when you're dealing with physical ailments, we have a pretty good sense of what the potential outcomes of a particular problem are. Meaning, a bone breaks. So a good doctor is able to tell you what you need to watch out for. Whether that's in terms of the way the bone is set and how it's going to heal, or whether that's in terms of whether there's any danger from the pieces of the bone for blood vessels, or all the other things that a doctor should be able to tell you about a broken bone, we have a pretty good sense of what the potential outcomes are. Same thing is true with a heart incident, same thing is true with a tumor, same thing is true with an infected wound. Of course, all cases can involve unpredictability, but there's a basic sense of what the set of concerns are. When you're dealing with the area of mental health, though, there are many ambiguities. The history of sophisticated, evidence-based study of mental illness is much briefer than that of many physical problems. You can measure it in decades. So that indeed does pose a challenge. Another challenge is the problem of diagnosis, because mental illness is often diagnosed via self-reporting. The person will exhibit certain symptoms, but generally speaking, you require the patient to talk about how they are feeling, what it is that they are experiencing, and that's very difficult. There's a personal and subjective nature to the condition that makes it hard to give an answer, not only hard halachically, but hard medically. A third challenge is apprehending the need for a particular course of treatment. It's often very hard to tell whether a problem that a patient is facing is a function of poor coping strategies or an actual biologically based illness. It's hard to tell whether the patient has personal agency to be able to deal with the problem. The extent to which treatment should involve medication versus involving counseling is also very unclear quite frequently. And so the question becomes, it's fine that Torchiner says we should work based on the impact, and the Jewish law looks at the impact. However, what about when the impact itself is unclear? Because the patient is self-reporting, because our knowledge is relatively new, because it's unclear whether something is biologically based or counseling based. So what are you supposed to do? So there's a Gemara in Avodah Zarah, which I think is very relevant here. And had I thought of this before I sent in the sheets for printing, I was very happy to be ahead of schedule, I would have included it on the sheets. But it only dawned on me after I had sent in the sheets, and so I said, all right, we'll leave it off. But for those who want to look it up, it's Avodah Zarah Chav Chet Amid Aleph. It talks about a phenomenon called Makash Shel Chalal. Anyone know what the term Makash Shel Chalal means? Makah, Memkaveh is... wound. Chalal, modern Hebrew means space, but that's not the way we're using it. It's inner space, I suppose you could say. Chalal means the space inside the body. What it's talking about is an internal wound. And what the Talmud writes is that if a person has makash shel chalal, if a person has an internal wound, or a person spikes a high fever, medicine of Talmudic times 2,000 years ago was not able to properly and responsibly diagnose and say, this is what's going on. If it was an internal wound, you didn't have the means of safely operating on people to open it up and see what's going on inside. You were dealing with a fever. There could be any number of causes, many of which were not visible to science of the day. And so the Talmud says, in a case of a makash shel chalal, in a case of an internal wound, or a case of someone who spikes a high fever, we do whatever is necessary for the patient medically, including violating Shabbat to take care of the patient, because we can't really analyze them well. And so we err on the side of caution. And I think the same thing is going to apply to our discussion of mental health. In many ways, the state of our medical knowledge regarding mental illness is what makash shel chalal was for them. We know something is wrong, but we don't know enough to say this is sufficient or this is insufficient, and therefore we're going to err on the side of caution. So that's my introduction. I am not used to speaking for 15 minutes straight at these classes. I'm hoping someone can interrupt me soon. But that's my introductory note. Is, yes, it's true, much of our knowledge of mental health has developed over the last 100 to 150 years, and even more intensely in the last 50 to 70 years. This is true. And that does pose a problem in terms of applying halacha to it. However, number one, halacha relies on impact. It looks at the impact. And the impact of illness was known long ago. It was observed. And therefore, you do have areas of Jewish law which will address the impact of mental illness, even without understanding its cause. That's number one. And number two, we have precedent in Jewish law for dealing with illness that we don't understand, like the internal wound. And the answer is, you err on the side of caution. Questions or comments on that before we go further? Heshi. So you ask a very good question. The question, as she asks, is this what's called sakanas nefashot, sakanat nefashot, danger to life? And the answer is that's one of the categories we're going to look at. We're going to actually look at four different ways in which mental illness impacts on the person and how halacha approaches those different impacts. So the first one that we're going to see is indeed threat to life, and you know the rule. The rule is, when in doubt regarding a threat to life, you override everything, right? Everything other than like idolatry and murder and like, but we hopefully aren't prescribing that. But that's the basic rule, and it's going to be germane here. Correct. Other questions or comments before we move into those four areas of impact? Okay. So, turning to the source sheets, we have four different areas of impact of mental illness, and for each one, halacha has assigned a certain weight to it and a certain protocol for how we're going to view it. And the first one is the one that Heshi mentioned, which is the issue of danger to the patient's life. So one example would be a case that I brought in number three, and that would be eating non-kosher food while the patient is institutionalized, where there is a fear of self-harm for the patient due to the patient's psychosis. The patient is experiencing hallucinations, the patient is experiencing delusions, there is fear of self-harm, so the concern would be, we need them in a place where they will be safe. In the place that they're safe, they can't get kosher food, I'm going to say, err on the side of saving their life. That would be one example of that. A second example of that, would be also a common discussion. You have a case in which a woman is pregnant. The woman became pregnant, and she realizes it a few weeks in. And she has a history of severe postpartum depression with prior pregnancies. She's had, make up a number, three pregnancies before, and it gets successively worse with each of the pregnancies, to the point where there is fear that she will be a risk for her existing children. And so the question becomes, what can you do regarding this pregnancy? What are the options that we're going to put forth? I'm not going to discuss abortion now as an issue. We did that as a session last year or the year before. But that would be a case in which we're concerned about a threat either to the patient's life or to the lives of others. So the rule in general is that fear of self-harm, whether that self-harm would be intentional or would be accidental, is recognized as what's called pikuach nefesh. Pikuach nefesh means saving a life, looking after a life, literally, but saving a life is always the way we translate it. That's correct. And we find that discussed way, way back. If you take a look at source number one, a passage in the Talmud. In the interest of time, I read out to the English, but I brought you the original Hebrew for authenticity as well. If someone is pursued by non-Jews, by bandits, or by Ruach Ra'ah, this is talking about on Shabbat, and you find out about it, and you're not able to help them physically, for any of these situations, someone else may cause himself suffering by fasting on Shabbat. You find out that somebody is in danger on Shabbat, even though normally one is not allowed to fast on Shabbat, one would fast for this person. Notice that one of the items listed is Ruach Ra'ah. Ruach Ra'ah, literally translated, evil spirit. As I mentioned already before, later on it gets translated as melancholy, some element of depression. My point in bringing it here is Rashi's comment. Right, which I bring you in number one. Rashi, writing in the 11th century, says, what is this Ruach Ra'ah? The spirit of a shade, some sort of a demon, enters him. And he runs about, and one prays lest he drown in a river or fall to his death. The fear is that he is going to jump from a high place. The fear is that he is going to drown himself. And the reason why I bring it here is to show the recognition that this person's experience, and again, whatever the cause, call it demonic, call it the four humors of the body, or call it depression, anxiety, doesn't matter. The recognition is that a person might be in a condition in which they pose a threat to their own health, and it is equated with an external threat, like being attacked by bandits. It is viewed as a threat to life. Rav Moshe Feinstein used this argument extensively in dealing with mental health issues in the mid-20th century. If you take a look at source number two, you find an example of this. This letter was actually written, but the part that I brought in number two, it's an excerpt from a letter written to Rabbi Yaakov Emanuel Shochet in Toronto in 1965. And the question was about committing a young man to an institution because of a fear that he might, as you'll see, harm himself in his condition. Take a look at number two. Rabbi Feinstein, if not the leading, then certainly one of the leading authorities in Jewish law in North America in the middle of the 20th century, wrote, "Perhaps there is room to debate regarding his illness. If doctors were to identify a life-saving issue, such as that he might respond to pain with suicide, or that he might violate civil law, not listen to the police, and resist such that they might kill him, or that the illness itself is dangerous, such that his brain is damaged, he can only be healed there. In all of these cases, that will be grounds for putting him into this institution, even though he will not be able to observe Jewish law while there, because there is a threat to him. But I can't really know. I don't know what the origin is of the dysfunction. Doesn't make a difference." That's Rabbi Feinstein rules there. He also deals with it in number 3, in a response regarding contraception for a woman who had experienced postpartum depression twice before. If you take a look at source number 3, recognizing that contraception is something that within Judaism has strong prohibitions involved, nonetheless, this is a circumstance where he's willing to justify it. He says, "Regarding a woman who became insane, the term in Hebrew is nishtate. She became irrational after the birth of her 2 children, such that the doctors forbid further pregnancy. May she use contraception?" And that's the question that's put to him. And Rabbi Feinstein responds, "Certainly his honor," the person who writes the question to him, "is correct. Insanity is dangerous not only for herself, but also for her small children. Even one whose insanity does not currently incline toward harm could still change, wanting to harm herself or her children, God forbid, and one cannot stand guard for this." What are you going to do? You're going to watch her every day. "Therefore, one should permit her." He's willing to accept the use of contraception in that case. So you're seeing the direction here. Without knowing necessarily all the science of the cause, you're seeing a concept of erring on the side of caution in order to preserve life. Now, this comes up in a fascinating Talmudic debate. There's a passage in the Talmud in Nedarim. We have a principle normally which says the following: if I have to choose between my life and someone else's life, I have the resources to save one person. It's either me or the other party. What do I choose? Myself first. Chayecha kodem, your life comes first. What if, on the other hand, the benefit for me is not a life-saving benefit? For them, it is a life-saving benefit. Right? So for me, I'm really hungry. I could use a burger. Huh, look at that, I have a burger. Veggie. On the other hand, this other person has not eaten in 3 days. Who gets the veggie burger? You'd say the other person, assuming there's no refeeding problem, assuming it's healthy for them, fine. The veggie burger goes to the other person. The other person needs it way more than I do. For them, their health is in danger. For me, I'm just hungry. Right? Those are basic principles within Jewish law. Then you get to a very odd case in the Talmud, in the Vam called Nedarim. They talk about the following scenario. There's a river. There's one town that is upstream. There's another town that is downstream. The people who are upstream have the option, theoretically, of damming the river and taking the water for themselves, or letting it go to the people who are downstream. People who are upstream say, "We're thirsty. We want the water for our drinking." As opposed to people downstream, it's, too bad. It's our needs first. So I'd say, look, if you need it for drinking water, then I understand. You take priority. But what about the case where the people who are upstream say, "We need it for our laundry"? Laundry. And the people who are downstream say, "We need it for our drinking water"? Who has priority? Downstream. Drinking is, drinking is more important than laundry. However, there is a position staked out in the Talmud which says no. It says there's a fear that if people go for a long period of time without clean laundry, it leads to shiyamum. It leads to what may be best translated as depression. And therefore, their needs come first. I like that. Take a look at source number 4. Rabbi Yisro Yehuda Unterman was at one point Ashkenazi chief rabbi of the state of Israel. And he makes a point regarding this passage in the Talmud. He quotes the work Hamek Sheilah by Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who explained that their debate, this debate in the Talmud about who has a right to the water, where one wants it for laundry and the other one wants it for drinking, depends upon the debate of Ben Petura and Rabbi Akiva regarding choosing between saving oneself and saving others. In other words, the Nitziv, Rabbi Berlin, author of Hamek Sheilah, is willing to say that laundry is equal to the need for drinking water. And he says, this is very shocking for me. One could not say this case involves actual danger to life, that the others would die. He says, it can't be that you're talking about where the people who are thirsty are going to die without it, and you're going to say that the laundry is of equal need. He can't accept that. How could Rabbi Yossi, who's the one who says the laundry comes first, how could Rabbi Yossi say their laundry precedes the survival of others? Even though dirty clothes can trigger depression, still, this is not at all imminent danger. It's not even considered potential danger, but something which could evolve into danger. Rabbi Unterman is of the belief that depression, mental illness, is not the same thing as somebody who needs drinking water. He says you're still several steps removed. Don't equate that with an imminent threat to life. That's his argument. And he says, I'll prove it to you. From source number 5, Rabbi Moshe Sofer was also known as the Chatam Sofer or the Chasam Sofer, depending on what kind of follower of his you were. Rabbi Moshe Sofer wrote a response on a case which we have already mentioned here. A case in which there's a young man, he's actually very young at this point, he's a minor still, he's under the age of 13, and he has some level of mental illness, and they want to put him, again, into an institution in which he will not have access to kosher food. And Rabbi Sofer goes through the argument that the young man is exempt from the obligation for kosher food at this point, not only because he's a minor, but also because of his illness, which is something we're going to come back to. And he says, you know what? You're not actively feeding him the non-kosher food. You put him there. The people who are running it, who are not Jewish, are the ones who are giving him the non-kosher food. You're not directly responsible. And look what he says in source number 5. This is a quote from Rabbi Sofer. Still, we conclude that from most authorities it seems clear that keeping him with non-Jews is not the same as personally feeding him non-kosher food. And he says, if so, one may do this, so long as they remove him when he reaches 13 in one day. When he reaches majority, you have to take him out, writes Rabbi Sofer. He doesn't want him to stay there. We're going to come back to that case. I'm not done with him. But Rabbi Unterman's statement is, as he reads Rabbi Sofer's responsum, he says, you can't tell me to take him out at the age of 13 if you really believe that mental illness is a threat to life. It must be that we look at it as further removed. So there is this school of thought. Not everybody is willing to say this is considered an imminent threat to life. Nonetheless, that school of thought is not the dominant view in general. And here we get to, again, one of those gray areas where you have to go back to the psychologist involved. You have to go back to the psychiatrist involved and ask, can you give me an assessment of what the risk is for self-harm? Now, no one can give you 100%. Not in physical health, and not certainly not when you're dealing with mental health. But the answer is, you do the best you can, and you err on the side of caution. So if they tell you, I've seen 50 cases like this, and in 40 of the cases, they were not really, as it turned out, a risk for self-harm, but in 10 of them they were, my answer is going to be 20% is too high a risk. I'm going to view that as a potential threat to life and not be willing to take the risk in that case. That would be the way we would look at it. One question that comes up, and then I'm going to demand questions from you because I have a cold, or getting over it anyway, and therefore I should take a break for a minute. One question that does come up, you're talking about somebody as being a threat to himself, a threat to herself, because of mental illness. So why not just put them into a situation in which they can't harm themselves? Take away all means of harming themselves, and then they won't be a risk to themselves, they won't be a risk to others, and you won't need to violate Jewish law. Why doesn't that work? Sorry? It's not possible. Number one, people are remarkably creative and inventive. It doesn't work that way. I don't care if you're in a locked unit. It doesn't matter. There are always going to be ways in which people are able to harm themselves. But more than that, from a halachic perspective, we don't require that sort of measure in order to get somebody to fulfill a mitzvah. Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein, writing in the beginning of the 20th century in his Aruch HaShulchan in source number 6, noted that when you walk on snow on Shabbat, you melt it. You're not supposed to melt snow on Shabbat. What the violation is an interesting discussion for another time. So he says, why don't we force people to stay indoors? And his answer is, because that's not the way Jewish law works. He says, number one, it's not a direct melting of the snow, it's indirect. That's number one. But number two, we would be locked inside all winter, and that doesn't exist. And the melting of the snow is a rabbinic prohibition rather than a biblical one. But as a general rule, we don't go that far. Rav Unterman was quoted by Rav Adi Yosef in that regard in source number 7. He's talking about somebody who is blind and dealing with treating blindness as a threat to life. Take a look at number 7. Rabbi Avadi Yosef wrote, I saw that Rabbi Yisra Yehuda Unterman wrote the following after distinguishing between levels of danger involved for a blind person and an epileptic. He wrote, I then thought one should not distinguish between them, between the person who is blind and the person who has epilepsy. There is substantive danger for the blind person as well, such that healing of a blindness will be called saving a life. It will be impossible for the blind person to stay at home eternally, and various dangers would lie in wait for him on the street. He must ascend and descend stairs. Danger is not absent, he says. We're not going to say that for this person who is blind, let's put them in a bubble, and therefore we won't treat blindness as a life-threatening condition. He says it's a life-threatening condition, and therefore it has to be treated as a pikuach nefesh situation. And so for that reason, we are going to look at mental illness as indeed a threat to life. Now, there actually is a more subtle way as well, in which a mitzvah or a halachic obligation could lead to harm to the patient's health due to the patient's disorder. Meaning it isn't only about concern for self-harm. It isn't only about concern for harm they might inflict on somebody else. But if the person is physically weak, then the added stress of the disorder may also potentially lead to harm for them. Rabbi Yitzchak Weiss dealt with this issue in a response in which I brought you in source number 8. The question he was asked was the following. He's writing this in the middle of the 20th century. You have somebody who is quarantined in a hospital for a condition. And it's the sort of condition for which, when the person was ready to leave the hospital, they would burn the person's belongings. So the question is, do you let him have his tefillin? Knowing that, there is a serious biblical prohibition against destroying the name of Hashem as it is written in the tefillin. And they're going to insist that for safety, they're going to want to burn the tefillin when he leaves the hospital. Are you allowed to give him his tefillin? He's very distressed. He can't imagine that he's going to go through weeks of treatment in the hospital not wearing tefillin. And Rav Yitzchak Weiss makes the argument, I brought it for you here, in source number 8. He says, in truth, a great scholar pointed out to me that if withholding tefillin could pain the patient, as he is depressed about missing the chance to don tefillin, and he is intensely God-fearing, he is concerned about being in the category of what the Gemara calls the head that does not don tefillin, God forbid, this depression could catalyze weakness of the patient's health, then one may be lenient to bring tefillin with him. And he, the person who Rav Weiss consulted with, showed me that the Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote thus to him regarding a patient where there was a question of permitting him to learn and study in a situation where it would otherwise be inappropriate. The statement that the Minchas Yitzchak, the Rav Yitzchak Weiss makes, is not talking about a patient where we have a concern for self-harm. It's not talking about a patient who might harm somebody else. But he's concerned that the stress of the mental illness may actually pose a threat to the life of the patient. And so for that reason, he's willing to look at it as, again, a pikuach nefesh situation. Another situation like this, Shmir Shabbos Kehilchas, Rabbi Yeshua Neuwirth talks about the issue of lighting a candle on Shabbos for the sake of somebody who is experiencing anxiety and who is already seriously ill. We know the Talmud talks about doing this for a woman who is giving birth. But in Halakha, we expand from that to those who in general are physically weak and they're going to experience stress and anxiety because of the lack of light. And once again, he says, this is considered to be a life or death situation. So what this gives us is impact number one out of four. And that is viewing a threat to one's mental health as a life or death situation, the impact being a threat to life, and on that basis saying, therefore, that we will override the halachic obligation of the situation. Are we clear? Does that make, yeah, Cheryl.
You spoke about burning all the clothes after he left.
Yeah. Correct.
Okay, so let's say he has Ebola and he survives, and he boards his fill-in during his treatment, but can he take, it's contaminated obviously, can he take it out?
I would hope not.
Right.
I mean, if there's a medical reason to think that the Ebola could be transmitted that way, it would be a violation of halacha for him to take it out. Yeah.
So you'd be allowed to burn it.
As needed. If there wasn't a better way to deal with the situation, yes.
Right,
Right. The question that Rav Weiss is dealing with is, are you allowed to bring it into the hospital knowing you're now putting it into a situation where the burning is going to be required? That was the issue. Yeah, once you're in that situation, then you're going to have to go through with that. Jeff?
Is the test always going to be whether you can create a reasonable mechanism of a threat to life, whether self-harm or by the illness? Or are you going to address pain and suffering?
That's coming next. Coming next, you can look at the heading for the for source number 9 and you'll see more. We absolutely have more to come. As I said, that's impact 1 of 4. Happens to be the others are briefer, so don't worry. But yes, we have a lot more to see. This was the easiest one. In other words, the case in which the belief is that there's a threat to life, whether direct self-harm, that type of thing, or even less direct because of the stress of somebody who's physically weak, that's relatively easy. There's actually another facet of this, but we're going to come back to it in number 4, so I'm not going to deal with it now. Other questions on that area? Yes. So here I'm going to go back to, well, actually, that second question, okay, let me divide that up into two parts. The first question, turning on music for somebody who is indeed dealing with depression. So here I'll go back to my opening disclaimer, which is, everything I'm saying is a general discussion of halachic issues, but specific questions have to be asked to your rabbi. And I say that because there are so many nuances of particular cases that you can't extrapolate from my generalizations. So I think that's very important to recognize. You also need to speak to the medical professional in the case to understand what the facts are of the patient's need. But you asked a second question there at the end, which threw me. The second question was, is it the patient who turns on the light? Can somebody else turn on the music for the patient? And the answer in the Gemara and in Halacha is very clear. Other people do it on behalf of the patient. It does not need to be the patient doing it personally. So that's an excellent point. Thank you for asking that. Okay. The second type of impact. Yeah. Sorry?
Not only the question of the candidate.
No, that's what they should do. Absolutely. 100%. 100%. Second potential impact, where what we're dealing with is not a threat to life, but a great burden. And here I include pain as one of the examples, but we'll see others as well. What about where there's no threat to life, but there is a great burden on the person? I'll give you an example. Somebody is dealing with OCD, and their OCD manifestation particularly surrounds issues of cleanliness. And I'll give you a case which unfortunately is common. It's not a terribly comfortable case to discuss, but it comes up, is when a person is davening, when a person is going to pray, they're obligated to make sure that their body is clean. And generally speaking, what that includes is they go to the washroom before they're going to daven, and they wipe themselves properly to make sure that their body is clean. So for healthy people, it's relatively straightforward and taken care of. However, for somebody who is dealing with OCD, they may have anxiety surrounding that. And they may reach the point where they're wiping themselves so many times that they actually cause themselves to bleed. And they delay past being able to pray with a minyan. They're causing themselves harm. It's not life or death. They're not going to die from it. However, this is a potentially painful situation, and unfortunately, as is the way of OCD, if this goes untreated, it can get worse and worse, greater manifestations, avoidance behaviors where they're going to avoid davening altogether because they can't bear to get into this situation, and so forth. That would be one case. Or, slightly different case. You have somebody who is agoraphobic. They have a phobia, they have anxiety that's triggered by being in crowds. Are they obligated to daven with a minyan? Can they pray at home as opposed to being obligated to go to shul because of this anxiety that they experience? Or do we tell them, no, you have to expose yourself to that which triggers your anxiety in order to fulfill prayer in the most ideal way? So that's our second type of a case. So we definitely recognize a variety of non-lethal harms as sufficient to override rabbinic law and even biblical law in certain cases. One example, when you're dealing with rabbinic law, is physical pain. We have a passage that appears in the Talmud many times, in rabbinic writing so many times, I'd even bring you a source on the sheet, because I think it's relatively familiar to people. The sages say, "Bimakom tsar lo gazu bei rabbanan." In a case of pain, the rabbis did not issue their decrees. Meaning that rabbinic decrees, generally speaking, and I say this as a generalization, it really requires a longer discussion in its own right to explain where it applies and where it doesn't apply. I'm being very broad. But rabbinic decrees are not applied to cases in which they will cause a person pain. That's talking physical pain. But not only physical pain. Embarrassment. I brought you a passage in source number 9. A classic. It came up in a class that we did a couple of years ago when we talked about human dignity. Rav Yehuda taught, quoting Rav, "One who finds shatnez in his own garment." Shatnez is a prohibited mixture of wool and linen. I'm not allowed to wear clothing that has wool and linen mixed together in it. Why is a really good question. Not for right now. But I'm not allowed to wear such a garment. I'm walking along with my clothing, and I happen to be a chemist or an expert in fabrics, and therefore I look down at the shirt and realize, oh no, there's actually some linen mixed into the shirt that I thought was just, well, shirts aren't made of wool. I don't know, come up with your own example. Clearly I'm not the fabric expert. I'm also not the chemist. But in any case, a person finds kilayim, he finds shatnez in his garment, he should remove it, even if he's in public. Why? A pasuk from Mishlei, a verse from Proverbs, there is neither wisdom nor understanding nor counsel opposite God. Meaning it's not for you to say your honor is greater than God's honor. If there's desecration of God's name, people are going to see that you're violating the law. You can't worry about your own dignity. The Talmud says, wait, not so fast. We've learned the following. After a funeral, when people are returning from the funeral, they have two paths in front of them. One of them is tahor, it is ritually pure. The other one is tameh. Ritual impurity is present there. There's a part of a body that was there. Something is there that communicates impurity. If the mourner takes the tahor path, then that's where they go with him. If the mourner takes the tameh path, the impure path, they escort him on the tameh path, including kohanim. A kohen is not allowed to become tameh. But to escort the mourner, he's supposed to do it. Why? For his honor. So the Talmud asks, I don't understand, you just told me desecration of God's name. How in the world can you put the honor of the mourner ahead of the laws of purity and impurity for the Kohen? And Rabbi Abba explained, what you're talking about there is what's called a Beit HaPras. It's an area where, biblically, there is no impurity, However, rabbinically, there's a decree to treat the place as impure. It's a long story. It's a place in which there had been something that communicated impurity, and we don't know where it is anymore, and it could be that it's on that spot. We don't actually know. So it's a rabbinic form of impurity, and this passage in the Talmud goes on to teach the principle, Gadol Kavod HaBriot, human dignity is so great that it overrides the prohibition of lo tasur mikol asherim ulacha yamin usmol, that the prohibition that says you're not allowed to violate the laws of the sages. So that rule that says you have to listen to the sages is overridden by human dignity. And this comes up in a variety of cases. I brought you one fun example in source number 10. From a work of Jewish law called the Shaar HaTzion bar Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, better known as what? The Chafetz Chaim or the Mishnah Brura, right? Author of both. So he deals with a case in which someone has something stuck in his teeth on Shabbos. And he's embarrassed, but he can't get it out. It's just wedged. Problem is, you can't make a toothpick for yourself on Shabbos because you are, by adjusting some piece of wood or whatever material you're going to use so that you can get the stuff out from between your teeth, you are fixing it on Shabbos. You're making it usable. That's mitakein. You're making the item that wasn't usable, usable. That's a violation of Shabbat. Look what he says in source number 10. He quotes you an earlier work called the Prima Gadim, who contends that the law permits cutting the splinter by hand. You can shape it using your fingers to pick one's teeth, where he has no other way to pick his teeth. It is as we have written that cutting the splinter by hand is only rabbinically prohibited, because it's a rabbinic prohibition. If you're going to shape it by hand, if you're fixing this thing by hand, you're allowed to do so in order to save your dignity. That's the basic principle. In order to avoid diminishing one's honor, one is able to violate rabbinic law. So here we are seeing, when you talk about burdens that could be imposed by a mental illness situation, you're talking about a situation in which the illness leads to physical pain sometimes. You could be talking about somebody, for example, who engages in self-harm that's not at the level of suicide. But if they aren't able to take their medications, then they are indeed going to experience physical pain potentially. Or somebody who is going to experience embarrassment as their symptoms are manifest perhaps in public, or as they are afraid to go to wherever it is that they need to go. Or a person who experiences mental stress. Just the stress of it itself can be justification. Ramban, in source number 11, deals with an issue of anxiety surrounding the laws of mikvah. The rules are that in cases of purity and impurity, a man or woman may be required to go to mikvah. A woman, after her period, may need to go to the mikvah. So when we talk about immersion in a mikvah, we talk about making sure that the body is entirely clean, that there is no chatzitza, there's nothing interrupting between the skin and the water. That's the concern for chatzitza. Well, looking for that on one's skin, if one has anxiety issues, oh boy, that can be a real challenge. What is this? What is that? Did I notice anything? Did I not notice anything? Rabban, in source number 11, is not dealing with somebody with any anxiety disorder. He says, in general, with the laws of chatzitza, one should not be overly strict, seeking doubts with which to disqualify immersion for minor matters. He says, there would be no end to this. Ein la davar sof. One should not insert his head into serious doubts which are interminable. That's the thing. That's the rule. You don't put somebody in that kind of situation, and you don't put someone in a situation in which they will feel stressed for other reasons. The Talmud in Moikatan in source number 12, Rabbi Yochanan said, the Nasi was the position of the political leader of the Jews in Israel in the times of the Talmud. The Nasi walks into the room, everyone is obligated to stand in honor of this person, in honor of the Nasi, except, says the Talmud, a mourner or somebody who is ill. Why not them? Writes the Levush, commenting on the tour on this issue in Tiradeya Shinayin Vav, for anyone who wants to look it up, because of Tsar. Because these are people, the mourner or the person who is ill, well, the person who is ill may have physical pain, but the mourner is grieving. You're going to make them stand up now. because the dignified person, this person of status, walked into the room. That's insensitive to the strain of their emotional state. So what you get here is a sensitivity to a burden which is not lethal. Mental illness here is not talk. We're not talking about life and death. But because of pain or because of strain, we may override certain rules, largely ones that are rabbinic, but occasionally biblical as well. Cheryl?
What if a man has an aversion to bugs and he doesn't want to be Gary? He wants to be cremated. The idea of him being in the ground, eaten up by worms.
So I'll tell you what. I'm going to ask the what ifs to wait until we get to some applications. Right. It's an interesting question. I'm not sure I'm going to answer it. But I know that if I'm going to answer it, it's going to be at the end.
Yes. I just want to say, and he makes the people, the children, or his community sign a letter.
All right, so it's a good question, but I'm really not ready for it right now. I want to get through the four types of impact first. So our first impact is life and death. Our second impact is the burdens of pain, emotional strain. Now we go into a third direction, and this is a very different one. And this is the fact that the person who is dealing with mental illness, depending on the kind of illness, may actually lack capacity to be obligated in mitzvot in the first place. Clearly, we're talking more along the lines of psychosis. At this point, a person with hallucinations, a person with delusions. But they may lack capacity to be obligated in the mitzvah. For example, what if you have... Well, I'm going to ask the question not only in a psychosis case. First, I'll give a psychosis case. You have somebody who is experiencing some kind of a manic state. It's Pesach night. Are you going to try to get them to sit down at the table at the Seder and eat the proper amount of matzah? I wish you luck. But the question is there such a responsibility? Is there such an obligation? That would be one question. Another question. Somebody has extreme anxiety, sort of going back towards the question that was asked before. Someone has extreme anxiety. However, they calm down if they're able to play an electronic game on their phone. Do you let them play that game on their phone on Shabbos in order to reduce their level of anxiety? Is there reason to be able to say that they're actually exempt from these laws? So here I want to deal with three different exemptions or possible exemptions, but the third one I'm not really going to deal with. And you'll see what I mean as we go through it. The first is what's called in Hebrew a shoteh, shin vav tet hey. A shoteh is somebody who displays irrational behavior. If you take a look at source number 13 on the sheet, you see the classic source on this from the Gemara in Chagiga. The sages taught the following. Who is a shoteh? Show of hands. Now, who is a shoteh? Who is somebody who we would define as being irrational such that Jewish law would consider them insane as a legal term? One who travels alone at night, one who sleeps in a cemetery, and one who tears his clothing. Rav Huna said, one who displays all of these symptoms at once. You need all three. Rabbi Yochanan said, no, even one of these behaviors is sufficient to put a person into that category. So Thomas says, wait a minute. Just for walking alone at night? But what is the case? If he acts apparently irrationally, even one act should suffice. Meaning, let's say you can see that he's doing one of these three things, and it's obviously in a manner that displays a psychosis. He's tearing his clothing. There's absolutely no justification for it. So then I understand. I don't need all three symptoms. And if he doesn't act irrationally, meaning if you can justify what he's doing, then even all of them would not suffice. And even if he displays all three behaviors, but I can understand all three of those behaviors, so why would you call him insane? He's not insane. So no. This is where he acts apparently irrationally. But one could explain each symptom in a rational way. You could come up with some justification. So once he performs all of them, it's like an animal that gores an ox, a donkey, and a camel. It's now identified as being dangerous for all animals. So too here. This person has run out of chances, so to speak. Then along comes another sage, Rav Papa, and he says, wait, Had Rav Huna heard the lesson from the Talmud, which says, who is a shoteh? One who destroys that which people give him. You destroy whatever someone gives you. He would have recanted. Then the Talmud asks, what do you mean he would have recanted? Does that mean he would have recanted, meaning I don't need to list the trait of tearing clothing because I have the trait of destroying that which people give him? Or he would have recanted from all of them and just said, this one? What are you left with? What are your symptoms? How does this work? So there's a lot of literature on this issue. That's, I'm sure, no surprise. And the general principle that we follow, and I brought you the Beit Yosef in source number 14 as dealing with this, but I'm going to say it outside of this, is, as a matter of Jewish law, we assume that these signs are not exclusive. These are examples. But you can have somebody who is a shoteh, who is considered to be insane, as a legal term, within Jewish law, they lack capacity because of behaviors that they display among these behaviors or other behaviors. Not only that, a person might be labeled as being irrational even if their mind is sharp in other ways. If you take a look at source number 15, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who I quoted earlier, he says the following. He says, certainly there's a difference between a shoteh and one who is exceptionally unintelligent. Being a shoteh is not about powers of understanding his affairs. The issue is not, does he have comprehension? Even one who is able to understand matters may have a confused, torn mind. Meaning he knows and understands that there are differences between the things he sees, but he errs in his delusions. And his delusions change in very brief periods of time. A person can be smart. And a person can be occasionally rational, or rational in particular areas, but irrational in other areas. And that comes up as a question within Jewish law. What if you have somebody who has a psychosis in one particular area, but is otherwise sane? I brought you in source number 16 from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law. The Hebrew is at the bottom of one side, the English is at the top of the next side. Regarding testifying in court, a shoteh is disqualified from testifying. And this is not only a shoteh who wanders without clothing and breaks implements and throws stones, but anyone whose mind is torn so that his mind is confused perpetually on some matter, on a specific matter. Even though he speaks and inquires on point in other areas, he is disqualified and considered a shoteh. He's considered irrational. And therefore, for our purposes, he will not be obligated in mitzvot. Now, this is a very hard judgment to make. Don't kid yourself. Going back to Moshe Sofer, the Chatam Sofer, who we quoted earlier, take a look at source number 17, in which he writes, judging in the matter of shotim is impossible, other than through the eyes of a judge who understands his nature. One cannot clarify his nature in writing. I can't give you a written description that's going to explain who is considered irrational, who is not considered irrational. You know it when you see it. As the Rambam Maimonides wrote, the judge only has what his eyes see. That's what you have to work with. You have to work with the judgment of the person on the scene. But this is one type of person who might indeed be exempt from the obligations of Jewish law. They don't have full rationality. And I'm going to go even further, because I said before, it's easiest to apply this to a case of psychosis. However, rabbis historically have applied it beyond the cases of psychosis, to cases of anxiety and depression as well. Take a look at source number 18, the Atarat Chachamim. Take a look at what he has to say there. His honor's wish, his honor again is the person who wrote to him. So he says, his honor's wish to innovate. The argument that you want to bring, that if irrationality derives from illness of black bile, right, which we call melancholy, then he is not a shoteh, is not clear to me. Let me back up and explain. The person who wrote to Rabbi Frankel Taomim wanted to make the argument that where depression is biologically based, and again, you're going back to the 18th century, so biologically based meaning the humors within the body being out of whack, that in that case the person is not called a shoteh, that person is not called irrational. That was what the person who wrote to him wanted to say. And he says, I'm sorry, I don't think that's true at all. He says, the class of melancholy, again, Hippocrates' word for depression, includes people who are entirely irrational, as is known to anyone who has some knowledge of the texts composed about this. As a result, if someone with melancholy displays perpetual behavior in a matter which demonstrates a torn mind, he certainly is within Rambam's category of shota, regardless of the cause. He says, I don't care whether it's bad coping mechanisms or biology. Fundamentally, a display of irrationality is a display of irrationality, and therefore, this person indeed will be said to lack capacity and will not be subject to obligations of Jewish law. That's his argument. Yes. So I don't want to say something about a specific case like that, because I think a lot depends on the circumstances of the case. However, we did note that destruction of personal property may well be accepted as a sign of irrationality. So there's something to be said, but I'm just not, you know, willing to go there and apply it as a generalization like that. More than this, though, it's important to recognize not all mental illness automatically makes a person a shota, even if we're recognizing that it's possible. And here I jump on the source sheet because I put it in the wrong place by mistake. Take a look at source number 22, please. Rabbi Chiel Michal Epstein deals with people who have depression. And what he writes is the following. People of black bile who do not perform any irrational acts, but only sit in sadness, far from human company, and do not seek to eat, but do eat when given food, and do not initiate conversation, but respond a little when addressed, and do not speak irrationally, one should analyze whether they have the status of shote or not. Logically, there is no sign of irrationality here, only a disease of sadness. It depends on the court's view to understand his ways and their causes. You're going to have to analyze case by case. But he says, don't make the leap to say all people with depression are therefore lacking capacity. He says it's simply not true. When a person gets on the other into the area of self-harm, Rabbi Yisr Zalman Meltzer wrote, I didn't bring it on the sheet, but it's quoted in the Otsar HaPoskim, he says, once a person is self-destructive, then you're in potentially the area that we would recognize as being irrational. Yes, Laura.
I'm not a psychiatrist, but sometimes people have coping mechanisms that we would look at if they're
really
now adopted, such as self-cutting.
Right. Yep.
So I don't know whether we would say they're using a poor coping strategy, but it's one that maybe works for them. We'd like to substitute something better,
right. But
they're not necessarily irrational.
Right.
So that looks like highly rational.
Right. It may put them in a different category. Right. Meaning, you're right. Non-lethal self-harm may not render somebody irrational for this category. However, because the nature of self-harm is that it tends to grow and spread, that these coping mechanisms are not static, it may put them in the first category of being a threat to their lives. But you're right, it would not necessarily constitute irrational behavior. One other area in this category that's important to recognize is the area called nechpaz. Anyone know what nechpaz means? What is chipazon? Relevant for Pesach night.
Haste,
right. We left Egypt, the chipazon, in a rush. I'm going to be speaking soon in a rush. So nechpaz means somebody who is gripped by haste, a state which may well reflect, depending again on the circumstances, mania. Rambam, Maimonides, in source number 19, talks about the laws of testimony and who is ineligible to testify. And he writes, those who are especially foolish, right, petty, we actually mentioned it along the way in one of the other sources, who do not recognize contradictory statements, do not understand matters as other normal people do. Also, here's the case for us, those who are confused and hasty in their minds, and those who are especially foolish, are in the category of shotim. It is as the judge sees it. One cannot specify a mindset in writing. He says, I can't give you a proper description in writing. But the Rambam Maimonides says that he gets it. It appears from Rabbi Yitzchak Alfasi, who was his father's Rebbe. He says that the case of the nechpaz, somebody who is confused and hasty in their thought process, is ineligible to serve as a witness, and the concern seems to be based on irrationality. If you take a look at source number 20, this is expanded upon by Rabbi Yeshua Falk in the Sefer Meirat Einayim commentary to the Shulchan Aruch. He says, quoting the words, "Those who are confused and hasty in their minds and who are especially foolish," he says, "it appears that the meaning of all of these types of disqualifications, is that they are not patient in their affairs. They perform all of their deeds hastily, not understanding the end of the matter and goal of the act. Therefore, this is also considered foolishness and irrationality." He's willing to call that person irrational. It's a strong statement. Similarly, Rabbi Shmuel de Medina, also known as the Maharash Dam, in source number 21, "It appears that none are more confused and hasty than a person who is struck with powerful fever. He is a shoteh, biblically disqualified." I think there's definitely an element of impulsive behavior here. I think you're right. And I'm not 100% confident that this is mania related. It sounds like it to me, but I'm not so sure. That's our category. Yes. So you could take it as simply physiological. In other words, it is somebody who is under the grip of a fever and have reached the point perhaps associated with fevers of hallucination, of delusion, and therefore that might be affecting their behavior in that way. But he couches it in a discussion about people who are not necessarily in the grips of some physiological fever, but are simply acting in a hasty way in its own right. Okay. This is your third area. Yes. Yeah.
And yet he's fully rational. Does he live in the category?
So the idea is that he's displaying irrational behavior in some way, and based on the sources that we saw initially from Rambam based on what we saw from the passage of the Talmud in 13, as well as the comment of Rabbi Yosef Caro in number 16, the understanding was that if he acts irrational on one point, we're going to view him as irrational in general, as long as he's perpetually irrational on this one point. That seems to be the way that we view it, which I have to admit is hard to understand. In other words, he's really only rational on this one point, but that's the way that it's classically understood. So this is our third type of impact. It is the impact which does not pose a threat to life, does not cause pain or great anxiety. However, it does potentially exclude them from obligation in various laws because they lack capacity. Shoteh and the person with mania, whether you can weave this into impulse, I'm not sure. Theoretically, I would include a third category here. I said there are really three categories, but only doing two. The third category would be ones, a person who acts under circumstances that are beyond their control because of a compulsion. And the reason I'm not going into that here is because I think that needs its own hour and a half. The whole discussion of whether you could apply ones to somebody who acts under the influence of mental illness, while fascinating, is beyond the scope of what we're going to get to tonight. Last impact. This one is unique. I would never have thought of this one, but then again, that's not my job. My job is to learn what others have said and report it. So that's what I'm doing here. This is a remarkable argument. It is that you need, so to speak, to burn the village in order to save it. The idea that if you don't treat their current condition, overriding halacha in order to do so, they're not going to be able to fulfill mitzvot in the future. You effectively need to violate halacha in this case in order to preserve it in the future. Example, the girl who's anorexic, forget the question of threat to life by fasting on Yom Kippur. That's not our focus right now. But she'll never be able to get a proper treatment and be able to fast on Yom Kippur in the future if you don't allow her to eat on Yom Kippur as part of her treatment now. That would be an example of this. And the argument is put forth by Rabbi Natan Tzvi Friedman, a rabbi in Israel, in his work, Netzer Mata'ai. I brought you the Hebrew, it's at the bottom of the first side, and then it goes on to the next side, it's source 23. And what he says is the following. I'm looking at the clock, and what I'm going to do is I'm going to paraphrase it rather than read it inside, but you can see it. I brought it there for you.
He says, the Talmud in Yuma discusses why it is that we override Shabbat in order to save a life. And it brings several arguments. One argument, the one that wins the day, is that the Torah says of the mitzvot, v'chai b'hem, you shall live by the mitzvot and not die by them. But it also brings another argument, which wins the favor of the sages there, even if it's not the winning argument in the altogether. And that is, chalel Shabbat achat kedei sheyishmor shabbatot harbe. Violate one Shabbat to enable the person to fulfill many Shabbatot. So if you have somebody who, in the case in the Talmud there, is under a ruin, the building collapsed on them, on Shabbos, if I dig them out, they'll survive and they'll observe many other Shabbatot. So I will violate Shabbat myself so that they will be able to observe Shabbos many times in the future. So he says the same thing should apply regarding mental illness. It may take the person out of their ability to observe mitzvot right now. Number one, that means that they're now perhaps exempt from mitzvot. They can't fulfill them. But number two, they're never going to have the chance to fulfill them unless you help them get the treatment they need, which requires that you break the rules right now. So that's the fourth impact of mental illness that will be recognized. It's preventing mitzvah observance now, and that's grounds for me to violate the law to enable them to observe in the future. Those are our four impacts. So go back to what I said in the beginning, right? Even though the knowledge 2,000 years ago of what the causes of mental illness are, biological bases, psychological bases, whatever, may not be anywhere near what they are today, doesn't matter. They're looking at these impacts and legislating in terms of the impact, which was visible back in the day. So what I'm going to do at this point is this. I'm going to go back to our initial four cases and discuss the application of these principles to each of the four. And then I'm going to open the floor to questions and discussion for those who can remain longer. But I want to make sure that people get that. And we said an hour and a half, and we're now at an hour and 15. So let's see if we can do this. Go back to the beginning. Our first case. Susan, age 14, is undergoing nutritional rehabilitative therapy for life-threatening anorexia. Her treatment team helps her develop healthy eating habits through regular meals while she works on her underlying emotional issues. Yom Kippur is coming. Must Susan fast? This is clearly category number one. It's an illness which we have defined as life-threatening. And again, if we were doing a class on eating disorders, we would talk more about why it's life-threatening. But what I bring you here in number 24 is my transcription of a recording of Rav Asher Weiss dealing with exactly this topic. The audio is available at the link there. Now, this is a good time for me to remind everybody who came in late, please make sure to sign in. This will ensure that you get my follow-up email from the session, which will include the digital version of these handouts, in which case you can click on the link in order to go there instead of having to retype all the different characters. In any case, Rav Weiss says, many times in the past, I poskened that girls suffering from anorexia could eat normally on Yom Kippur, not l'shiurim. L'shiurim means where you tell them eat a minimal amount that doesn't really qualify entirely as eating. He says, no. Not l'shiurim, because even though there is no direct sakana, no direct danger, it's a terrible ailment, and people and girls die from anorexia to my dismay. I personally know a few families that lost children to this terrible malady, and the way to treat them is difficult, and it's a long haul, and it takes a long time to design a plan of eating. And any interference, any interruption with that pattern could set the patient back months or years and ultimately could endanger the patient's life. So it does seem to be a chiddush, a novelty to many. Some rabbanim didn't really agree with my psak, but my psak was that girls suffering from anorexia, Yom Kippur, should eat in the normal pattern that was worked out in the personal tailored plan for them, and they should not try to eat l'shiurim. He says it's a matter of life and death. He, of course, is, as many of you know from previous classes where I've quoted him, the rabbinic authority for Shaarei Tzedek Hospital in Israel. So that's in terms of our first case. What about our second case? The victim of abuse. David, age 55, has been in counseling for 30 years for anxiety attributed to lifelong emotional abuse by his father. The abuse was largely verbal, criticism and insults from early childhood through the present. David's father passes away. Is David obligated to sit Shiva? And this case is one that I've seen versions of over the years. In this case, I also lifted a little bit from what a doctor actually sent me. So, number one, it's important to recognize what I brought you in source number 25, the ruling of the Rambam of Maimonides, that in general the laws of Shiva are biblical only on day one, and that only if that's the day of the death and the burial. Otherwise, what you're dealing is rabbinic law. And that matters because we're dealing with our second category. I'm assuming right now, for the sake of this case, that it would not be a threat to his life for him to do this. It will be painful. It will be upsetting. But I'm assuming that he's not in a life and death case. If he is in a life and death case, then I have no further discussion. But if it's an issue of the stress, the pain, the anxiety, the depression, that's not life-threatening for him. So we have a few points. First of all, it's worth knowing the rule that I brought you the Rama about in source number 26, which is that mourning is technically not obligatory for a Rasha, for somebody who is wicked. Somebody who violates laws perpetually. One of the laws that we have is Onas Devarim. You are not allowed to abuse other people, not only the classic physical abuse, sexual abuse, but emotional abuse is biblically prohibited. His father was violating the law every single day. That's number one. Number two, the Maharshal, Rabbi Shlomo Luria, wrote something very curious in source number 27. He was dealing with a case in which a husband and wife were not getting along. The husband had already decided he was ready to divorce his wife. He just hadn't gone through with everything yet. And then she passed away. And the husband says, I really don't want to sit Shiva for her at all. We didn't like each other. We didn't get along for each other. Not interested in sitting Shiva. So look what he writes, Rabbi Luria. He says, further, how could one think to make him mourn when his heart does not grieve? It's not a bitter day for him. Granted that for actual mourners, meaning blood relatives, our sages did not distinguish between friends and enemies, here he says there's room to distinguish. Now the truth of the matter is we don't paskin like him. His view is not accepted as halacha. However, Eretz Chemda in Israel, which is a rabbinic body that deals with practical questions and answers questions from around the world, issued a responsum on an abuse case in which they quoted this and said, you know what? Rabbi Luria's logic, first of all, is that the laws of mourning were not created for a situation in which there's no emotional connection and where there's no emotional feeling. But number two, we have a principle in the laws of mourning. Halacha kedivrei hamekel be'avel. The law follows the lenient position when you're dealing with avelut, when you're dealing with mourning. And therefore, they argued that this is a position we could add to, we could use, in building a case for not having to mourn. So you can build it from the fact that, number one, it's a rabbinic obligation. Number two, the father is considered to be a violator of Jewish law in this case. Number three, there's no feeling of grief. Number four, what I brought you in source number 28, Rabbi Mark Drash wrote an article called Honoring Abusive Parents. It's actually available online. And he quoted Rav David Cohn, a major authority in Jewish law today. And Rav David Cohn is not talking about Shiva. He's talking about kibud. He's talking about honoring one's parents. And look at what he said, number 28. Rav David Cohn suggests yet another reason for exempting an abused child from the obligation of honor, asserting that there are limits to how much a person is allowed to spend in order to fulfill a mitzvah. No more than one-fifth of one's monetary assets for a positive commandment for a mitzvah. He argues that emotional distress and psychological consequences are excessive personal costs that free one from an obligation. He maintains that halacha does not re-victimize abused children by forcing them to honor their abusers. That will be a price much too high to pay. That's not even talking about Shiva. That's talking about kibud, about honoring them. Plus, he then goes on to say, and it's in the part that I quote on the next side, the paragraph that begins, another factor that supports exemption from mourning is that most, if not all, mourning rituals are rabbinic obligations, and in general, rabbinic rulings are sensitive to their impact, financial and personal, on those who are to observe them, providing exemptions when those obligations exact significantly adverse consequences. And he invokes what I mentioned before, b'makom tzar, in a case of pain, the rabbis did not institute their rules. So on that basis, indeed, and this is a ruling that I know has been implemented in many, many circumstances. Unfortunately, you know, we live in a society in which this is not nearly as rare as it should be. But the rule is that the child is not obligated to sit Shiva in that case of abuse. There's more to be said about that. I read one discussion which argued that maybe the mourner should sit Shiva because of closure, and maybe it'll be good for them to be able to do it. I leave that to the psychologist in the case involved, because that's a psychological question. That's not a rabbinic question. That's a question that has to be addressed through counseling, not through a halachic ruling. But that's your second category, is the issue of pain. Third category, the issue of the person who is exempt from mitzvot. That takes us back to our discussion about the person who is going to be put into the institution where they can't get kosher food. So I already told you what Rabbi Moshe Sofer ruled, the Chatam Sofer. However, his ruling is taken in two different directions. Some look at his ruling, as Rabbi Unterman said, and said, clearly we don't believe that this person is in danger, because look, Rabbi Sofer said, take him out when he turns 13. However, others have argued that Rabbi Sofer only said this as an add-on, it will be good to get him out, because we are taught that non-kosher food is actually bad for a Jew. What that means is a really good question, but this is a tradition that we have. But they argue that the core halacha, as recognized by Rabbi Sofer himself, is that one indeed may keep him there. Why? Not necessarily because his life is in any danger, but because as a shoteb, because he is irrational, he's not obligated in mitzvot. Last case. The last case that we brought was Avram, who has OCD, and the psychologist wants to have him recite the prayers just once. Even if the pronunciation is no good, you say it and you just keep right on going. Don't repeat it. So here I quote again Rav Asher Weiss in source number 29, this time from a written responsum, dealing with this question. He says, doctors who are expert in this field believe that the way to treat it is that he never repeat any statement or prayer. When it is clear as the sun to him that he has not said the name properly, the name of God, he has not fulfilled his duty and his bracha and his blessing, may he eat. And he writes, even if we would say that one may not violate a prohibition for medical purposes, our case is different. For if he would not be healed and freed from his crisis, he would violate these mitzvot forever. The argument that we saw before. Let him violate it now in order to be able to fulfill it in the future. In any such case, we say better to desecrate one Shabbat and not desecrate many Shabbatot. It appears in our case too, this precious person may cancel blessings and Shema to be healed so that he will be able to fulfill these mitzvot properly. Parenthetically, Rabbi Weiss also makes the argument in the audio recording that I had of his that maybe even this is the way the person says the word. That's his way of pronouncing them, and maybe it is considered to fulfill his obligation. But that's a separate argument. The point that I hope we're getting across is that halacha absolutely recognizes the impact of mental illness in all of these different ways and has a means for dealing with these problems. The big question is, when will we have enough information medically to be able to give a proper answer? Until that time, it's makasha halal. We don't know. It's like the internal wound being dealt with 500, 1,000, 2,000 years ago, where you'd say, err on the side of caution because we don't know enough. Hopefully, as medical science advances in its understanding of what's going on and of what the treatments are, the rabbinic rulings will also become more precise. But I close, and then again, I'm going to stick around for discussion, but I said an hour and a half, and I want to honor that. Take a look at source number 30 with a very important comment from Rabbi Shlomo Wolbe, which I translated for you here. You can see at that link, and again, those who are on the email list will be able to get the link in the clickable format. He has a much longer article. I just took this excerpt. He writes the following about the importance of training rabbis in this. He says, we have said that ignorance causes a delay in connecting the ill with psychiatric treatment. Relatives, friends, educators notice that someone is suffering or behaving oddly, but it doesn't enter their mind that they are seeing a case of emotional illness. I paused for a second because I realized I did not introduce this. Rabbi Wolbe was a leading rabbi in Israel towards the end of the 20th century, a leader in a yeshiva, and somebody whose word is taken very, very seriously. So he says, the educators don't realize they're seeing emotional illness. More than occasionally, they advise a depressed youth to marry early. Sometimes it's good advice, but not in a case of manic depression and the like. Only a psychiatrist can determine this. Or another case, it happened to me twice that students came to me in a panic and while crying powerfully complained that, quote, they have lost their faith. This was a schizophrenic episode. They needed urgent care. I assume that what happened to me twice also happens to other rabbis and educators who do not know anything about psychiatry. We can imagine that in such a case, they would try to calm the ill person and strengthen his faith. And certainly they would come to know later they did not succeed. But in the interim, precious time would be lost and the ill person could come to treatment with a fateful delay. These problems are shared by the observant community and the psychiatrists. There is an urgent need to organize courses for active rabbis and educators with the goal of spreading basic knowledge of the symptoms of neurosis and psychosis and their modes of treatment with general guidelines so that they will know to direct ill people to doctors early on. Basic knowledge would remove many prejudices. And indeed, that's what we need. What we need is the spread of this information to have conversations about this, and hopefully that will lead to the people who need treatment being able to get it early on and in an effective way and having a refuah shlema. Thank you very much.